You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Must come from just years of deep thinking.
Yeah.
And writing.
Cunnilingus.
And cunnilingus.
It's that throat cancer.
I think that's all horseshit. I think that's all bullshit.
We'll see, man. I mean, how old's he?
I don't know. 60 something, yeah. But I mean,
so,
I got
30 years
cancer,
left.
Throat cancer from eating, you know, snatch or whatever you want to call it.
I'm just saying if it's true, I'm going to have throat cancer. There's no question.
Well, there's
about
no
that.
Question. I mean, I remember doing things like just going there immediately. I don't even know her name, and I just
correct.
Go right, you know, like that's what that's called a man.
There's certain primal instincts that
yeah,
the wolf
I'm dirty.
Cannot deny.
I'm dirty. I haven't taken a shower. I give a shit.
My high school girlfriend, this was the first everything with this girl. And I remember one day she had just gotten done playing a beach volleyball game for like 2 or 3 hours out in the hot sun. And it wasn't even like not even time for you to stop sweating.
And you went right down.
Yeah. It was like licking a 9-volt battery. But it was done.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It tasted like Heineken. My guest is Chad Kultgen. I don't even know what Kultgen is. What is that last name?
I'm not even sure either. I think it's German. My dad was adopted, and I know they're – so I don't have really any blood relation to the name.
Well,
but,
you're a blonde. You're a real blonde, but you have a sharp aquiline. You have a Spanish nose.
Well, there you go.
And you have the kind of eyes that Modigliani would paint. God, am I deep or what?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, I'm going to use a lot of that. Chad Kultgen is an author, and if you haven't read his books, you're out of your mind. Your books are basically pornographic, but there's something about them that makes you feel deeply.
They're certainly pornographic. I mean, they deal with human sexuality in all kinds of different ways, I guess. But I get asked that question sometimes.
But they're good books. They're not pornographic. They're good books. There's a difference.
They're technically pornographic.
They are, but there's something else going on. I actually, the overwhelming, like for average, what I think it's average American male, the overriding sort of the thing that I think it was about was a guy looking for connection. He felt like it was like that. It was almost like what something Albert Camus would write, you know, kind of like a stranger.
All right. Yeah, that's maybe Albert, a little lofty.
I pronounced it wrong. Albert Camus.
There you go. That's what I was offended by. The pronunciation. No, I'm saying I don't know that I'm quite worthy to be mentioned in the same breath. But yeah, certainly it is about that kind of stuff. I mean, all my books are really about that. People searching for connection and what is this modern world we're living in and how relationships are affected, social relationships, intellectual relationships, sexual, certainly. But for me, if you're going to write about sex, you have to write about sex. I've never had sex that's not pornographic. It's always real dirty.
That's
always.
Right. That's right. I agree with you. I mean, that is sex, isn't it? It's at its core, it's saliva and swap and spit and everything else. But you you've always struck me as a guy who is really in a good way cynical, or at least you just don't get that excited about a whole lot. Now, you've had recently, you know, your book was just turned into a movie directed by Ivan Reitman.
Jason Reitman.
Jennifer Garner starring, Adam Sandler starring in a serious role, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, certainly career-wise, I think it's the biggest deal that's ever happened to me.
So what happens to you there? Now, how do you feel?
Fantastic. I can't wait to see the movie. I think it's going to be great.
What does it do to you as a writer? Does it do you relax? Do you find yourself relaxing or working on your next book?
No, I never relax. I'm always working on the next thing. I mean, as soon as I finish writing something, I'm done with it. And then whatever happens to it after that can happen. But I'll, you know, usually it's out of my head. Whatever I've kind of wanted to explore with whatever I was writing is done for me. The exploration is over. And now it can take on life as a movie or, you know, to people who read the book or whatever. And I'm happy to answer questions about it and all that kind of stuff, what my original intent was. But I think for all artists, really, whether they know it or not, once you create something and put it in the world, you don't own it anymore. You have nothing to do with it anymore, in fact. Mm-hmm. Whatever your original intent was, whatever you thought you put in that thing may or may not be there, but now it's up to anyone else who views it to tell you what is actually in it. And anything someone finds in it is in it, whether you wanted it there or not.
That's really interesting, because I heard Melville say, and then maybe he was being tongue-in-cheek, but he said when he wrote Moby Dick, he was not writing allegory. He was just writing a story. And everybody else, of course, teaches classes on, you know, the symbolism of the white whale and
sure.
Ahab and all that. And maybe he's right. That makes sense, though. You just put it out there.
I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of authors have stuff like that where they go back and they say about whatever their most famous work is. Like, yeah, it was just some bullshit I wrote one night drunk. Didn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, Joy said that apparently about Ulysses. Like, go kiss, fuck you.
Yeah, and who knows? Surely they're being smartasses in that scenario. But, I mean, for me, it really is kind of like once I'm done with that thing, I'm already thinking about whatever the next thing is. But
do you find yourself exploring the same theme over and over? Because a lot of people, they say writers write the same story over and over again in one way or another, right?
So, yeah, I mean, constantly. I explore the same stuff again and again and again and again because they're the things that interest me.
What are they?
Human sexual relationships, social relationships, how technology is changing society, religion.
Are you religious?
That's about it. No, I'm anti-religious, if anything. Anti-theist, I would say.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you, do you believe in monogamy?
Believe in it in what way?
Well,
do I support it or do I believe that it exists?
That's a really good question to my question. I guess what I'm saying is if you tried to write for mainstream TV, a guy as
forget mainstream TV. You can't even do it on cable.
Can't even do it on cable.
You can't do it anywhere.
If the guy is straying, if the guy's having sex with other women, and we like his wife or his girlfriend, that guy's lost to the audience. You're not getting him on the air.
He's lost to the audience unless he is such a big character or like played
Tony
by
Soprano.
Such a handsome man like John Hamm. Don Draper's a good example. Mm-hmm. He bangs all these chicks, but we're okay with it because it's a period piece, and it's set in this era where we say, well, that's what guys used to be like, but not anymore.
Right.
Well, guess what? We're all still like that. We'll be like that until the end of time.
Right.
But if you set that in a contemporary setting and you say, guys like this are like this, your husband is like this, your boyfriend is like this, that's not going to fly on TV.
No.
Because there is really no honesty in most contemporary media, TV, movies, books.
Or maybe in most relationships, contemporary relationships, male, female.
Well, certainly not. There's, I don't know if it was in some TED talk I saw or something, but it was about truth-telling and deceit. And they had all these stats that were about, in the first 5 minutes of meeting someone, you lie to them three times. Between men and women who are in relationships, they lie to each other. It was something on the order of like 20 times a day.
I believe it. In fact, I don't even think they come to each other. I don't even think they come to each other as who they are. I think that most relationships that I see, both people are playing a character. The men are playing much harder and more male than they really are, and women are doing the opposite.
That's in any relationship, though, not just sexual, I think, or not just romantic. Friendships, business relationships.
Yeah.
You always bring some identity to whoever you're talking to. And, I mean, even when you're just with yourself, your relationship with yourself, you're never all the things you are at once. You can't be.
Mm. That makes sense. So in terms of your own relationships, trying to navigate that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard not to be cynical, right? I mean, when you're in my position, you have a wife and children.
Right.
My stakes are very high.
Mm-hmm.
So if I stray and I get caught, for example, there's hell to pay.
Right.
So there's the saying that punishment doesn't change behavior, but it suppresses behavior. It can suppress behavior. So in a way,
what you're talking about, though, there's hell to pay for you. In a kind of practical nature, the emotional hell you pay when a relationship ends after you've been caught doing something bad, I think is potentially comparable. Let's say you've been married for 10 years versus you've just been dating someone for 10 years.
Yeah.
The marriage ending means practically you're going to have to do a lot of bullshit. You're going to have to go through a divorce potentially and lose all your money and blah, blah,
all
blah,
that,
blah,
yeah.
blah. Whereas a girlfriend, you just cry a little bit if you're that type
That's
of guy.
True. Well, also, but there's also the note that actually there's the other thing, which is you are lying to somebody, right?
Sure.
And you're being, I guess, unethical, immoral, or whatever. That would be the argument.
Yeah.
How do you navigate that?
I'm a moral relativist. First of all, I don't think there is good or evil, right or wrong. But certainly the golden rule is kind of something I try to live by. And you don't want to shit on somebody you care about because you don't want them to shit on you.
Right.
I've certainly been in many long-term monogamous relationships. I prefer it. There's a level of comfort that it affords you that I think is worth forsaking the opportunity to have sex with whoever you want or, many partners. I don't know. I prefer it.
But that's kind of what I'm getting at. It's interesting. As I get older, I realize that there are these urges and these appetites. And it's funny that we have nostalgia in one way or another, as you get older, as an adult, we have a form of nostalgia, I suppose, or this need to reach for what would be the ideal behavior as it's been given to us. And in some ways, I think that that's almost, you could say, well, that's been pushed on us, put on us by society. Maybe not. Maybe there is a moral default that human beings want to sort of rest at, which is monogamy, not lying, not killing, not cheating. These are the things we want to be.
But
right?
It's not a moral default. It really is just about comfort. Human beings seek comfort in every aspect of their lives, whether that's having enough money to buy a nice house, having a pretty wife, having nice kids, eating what you want to eat, driving a nice car, whatever. And so all those things are just to the end of being comfortable. And so monogamy is very comfortable. You don't have to go out every night. You don't have to put any effort out to have sexual satisfaction. You don't have to put any effort out to have a person in your life at a certain point. Once it becomes a really monogamous relationship that you both agreed on, you don't have to put any effort to find that. You have
it. Yes, but then comes kids, then comes things in the relationship, then comes boredom, then
comes... Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know. Obviously, things change. Yeah, the nature of all relationships change.
And then it becomes uncomfortable sometimes to be to not be a scumbag, right?
Right, you know? Exactly.
And therein lies the rub. Yeah. I just wish there was more of a... You can't even have the conversation in a mainstream, you know, medium. I mean, because... No. You're demonized immediately. You can have problems eating too much. You can have problems with alcohol, with drugs, and you're a sympathetic character.
That's right.
If you have problems with keeping your dick in your pants, or you know, and God forbid you're a woman and you start banging other men, women will come down on you just as hard.
It's because it's perceived as the problem. All those other things you're doing to yourself. If you are screwing around with your wife or whatever, you're harming another person.
That's right, and the kids possibly, and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people don't like that. And you're harming them in a way that's purely emotional. It's not like, and I think that's why people have such a problem with it, because we all know that we have the urges. I mean, if you have the urge, you're aware of it.
Yeah.
And all humans have the urge to have sex outside of whatever relationship they're in. We all do. Even if it's momentary or fleeting. But it's difficult to vilify it immediately, but we all have to kind of on the surface agree that's not how our society is going to work. Whereas with murder or something, it's immediately evident. This guy is an evil person.
Right.
We can all agree he's bad.
Right, right.
But yeah, sex is a whole different thing.
Well, you know, but there's this dichotomy with people. I interviewed a SEAL Team 6 guy, a really interesting guy. And on one hand, he's a killer. On one hand, he's clearly taken many lives, up close and personal. He's not going to talk about that, but I happen to, you know, I know this about him.
Of course.
And yet, you know, his best friend's daughter, his best friend died, and his daughter was kind of left in the lurch, and he does things like treads water for 24 hours to raise money for her. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just an interesting thing where, you know, somebody can be, they can tap into the dark side, they can sort of almost deviate to the sociopath and then come back as the greatest guy in the world.
But it's not a sociopath.
No, it's not. It's not.
In that case,
he's not. I'm just saying that you certainly can go over to behaving in a way where you can, I guess, say these people are the enemy. I'm going to take them out, even if they might be innocent bystanders. Yeah. That's part of war. And then I'm going to come back over here and be the sweetest guy in the world or be sacrificed
or something. That really is why. I mean, that's kind of the core of why I'm a moral relativist, and I think. Whether people want to admit it or not, we all are. Because that guy on SEAL Team 6 who went and put a bullet through Bin Laden's head, none of us say, bring him up on murder charges. We're all for that.
Right.
We're all like, yep, that was a good kill, right? A clean kill.
That's right.
Well, although your sweet Jesus Christ told you not to kill anyone, regardless of anything, and turn the other cheek when you get hit. So when 9/11 happens, you don't wage war. You say, please don't do that again. I understand why you did it. And that's it.
Right.
But, you know, our country is screwed. It's full of a lot of hypocrites, many of them religious in that respect, I think. But, yeah, I mean, we all kind of really don't believe in good and evil because there are evils that we all accept as good.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's almost like, you know, people say human life is sacred. And I always say, yes, of course, I like that ideal. But if you really, you know, wanted to save a lot of lives, actually, you know what you could do? You could lower the speed limit to 35 miles an hour. You would save a lot of lives. We'd be life would be slower and you wouldn't get to shit on time and people would get a lot more tickets. But you could actually put a governor on every car to not let it go past 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And we'd save a lot of lives.
Or get rid of alcohol altogether or cigarettes or whatever. I mean, there are, clearly we don't really care about human life.
Well, we care about
we care about our human lives.
We also care about friends, personal choice and freedom and personal responsibility, which I think is very important. That's why I'm a libertarian. I mean, I just think, you know, let people decide. Let people. Let
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, their own choices.
100%.
It's the age old question. What And so those are the themes you kind of try to explore with
that. yeah. All that's in there some way, as one way or another. It's in there somewhere and all the shit that I
write. But you live in a town where it's very easy to feel disconnected.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of what I write about is kind of middle America stuff. So maybe in some way it's me struggling to connect with what I perceive as the normal human life in this country. And, you know, and like you said, not only do I live in a town that's completely disconnected, but I have a job that disconnects me from most personal interaction. I just sit in my apartment all day typing on a keyboard.
That almost is a personality trait though, isn't it? I mean, isn't that, you're a writer. I mean, you always, how did you become a writer? What do you think about your childhood?
I don't know, man. I read a lot of like science fiction and stuff when I was a kid. Certainly I held writers in high esteem as I did like pro athletes and stuff like that.
Yep. Who are your favorite writers?
Isaac Asimov is my favorite writer of all time.
Really?
Sci-fi guy, yeah.
Yeah, my father told me that he listened to Isaac Asimov give a speech, and Isaac Asimov said, I'm going to tell you a story off the cuff right now. And he told this incredible story that he just made up on the spot.
Yeah.
He said, that's my gift. I can bring it all the way around and just improvise an incredible story with everybody in the room. Names and...
Yeah.
And my father, who reads, has probably read everything, was just so floored by this guy.
Yeah, he was an amazing intellectual as well, beyond just being a great sci-fi writer. The guy was super smart, which I also, you know, held in high esteem. But, yeah, I'm sure, you know, as with you, like, why'd you get into comedy? I'm sure there was some childhood influence. You saw George Carlin or something.
It wasn't even that. I just was moved around so much as a kid. I wanted to make friends. I wanted people to like me.
Huh, it's interesting.
And so you know, the way in with guys is sports and being a jackass. I was okay at sports, but I was way better at being a complete jackass.
You know,
I'm friends with a lot of pro athletes. They don't hang out with me because I can throw a football or punch somebody in the face well. They just hang out with me because I make them laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was always sort of, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think I read a lot of comic books, a lot of sci-fi, and I always just kind of thought writing was really cool. It was the medium that I really liked more than any of the others. I watched a lot of TV comedy and stuff when I was a kid, too, which I think kind of angled me in that direction as far as what I write in movies and TV. But
played baseball. You were pretty athletic, right?
Yeah. Played high school sports and all that.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you weren't a nerd because you're a pretty athletic guy.
No, I was on the baseball team and football team and all that, and I probably could have played like college baseball had I not gone to USC or... If I had gone to, you know...
Smaller school.
But, yeah, and I still maintain some level of athleticism, even my old age now. You know, like, I play in a rec league on the weekends, baseball.
Yeah, you have a beautiful body.
Thanks.
I mean, we're gonna tweet out some naked pictures of you, obviously.
Yeah,
sure. Wearing, you know, you can cover up with your iPhone or something.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. All right. What are you going to write now?
Become
a famous writer.
Yep,
I'm you got some stuff going on here. It's kind of cool. Kate Walsh is doing your NBC pilot.
Yep, we're casting that one right now.
And then you got and I think Adam McKay and Chris Henschke doing the rewrites on that.
They are.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And then you got Jason Reitman, who's a great director. I don't think he's done anything that I didn't love from
Up in the Air
to Juno. And he's now directed your movie.
It's not my movie.
I mean, the book that you wrote was adapted as
right.
And then that's kind of the pinnacle in some ways. In a way, right? It's interesting, though, like, talk about that a little bit, because in a way, as a writer, you come to Hollywood and you're doing it. I mean, this is you're in the game. And
I'm certainly in the game, but I wouldn't say that I'm near the top of the game even. It's a weird thing, because I've sold at this point, I don't even know, maybe 15 or 20 TV shows to various networks and cable outlets and stuff like that. None of them have ever gone to series. A few of them have made it to pilot. And at some point you realize, you know, your job is the thing that you have subsisted by doing for the last, you know, 10 years roughly, is writing these little 35 to 40 page documents that a room full of 12 people read and then throw in the trash can. And that's your job.
God.
And it's just like,
God,
That's certainly not what I came here to do, but it has afforded me this life where I don't do anything else. Like, I'm just sitting. My job is not easy necessarily, but certainly it's not anything I hate. I really like doing it.
Yeah,
But
that's what's, it's such an act of faith, isn't it? Like, because you kind of like keep writing, and then finally, 10 years later, you know, some A-list or very talented, really good people adapt your book, and now it's, and then, you know, you got Kate Walsh and an amazing team around Bad Judge.
Well, the books are slightly different, though. I mean, those are kind of their own reward. They certainly don't pay as much as TV or movies, but they are creatively far more fulfilling because I get to do whatever I want, and I take notes from no one, et cetera, et cetera. But the TV show thing is, I mean, as you know, it's kind of a lottery.
Yeah.
And every year, if you sell another show, it's just like they give you a lottery ticket, and maybe yours will get on the air, maybe it won't. But at some point, the accumulation of all these things you've written that no one has ever seen or know about, they don't know about it. Especially when you're like talking to someone, you're like, oh yeah, I'm a TV writer. Oh, what have you written? What have I seen? Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, then what do you mean? Well, then you have to explain it. Like, well, every year in the beginning of the summer, all the writers go out and they pitch their ideas to all the networks and, you know.
Explain the process.
Okay. And every summer, all the writers like me, we go out and we pitch our little ideas to all the networks. And every network buys, just on the comedy side, the same thing happens on the hour long. But on the comedy side, every network buys like 60 to 70 scripts from writers like me, anywhere from, you know, I won't get into the money, but you can make like a decent amount or a shitload of money. I'm somewhere kind of in the middle, I think, but just for the script. So then you sell your idea, and from then until roughly the end of January, beginning of February, you do multiple drafts, getting notes and all this kind of stuff, and your original idea will be changed dramatically, usually, into something that you never wanted.
By a bunch of non-writers.
By a bunch of people who do not write, but they are the ones paying you, so you do what they say.
And what is their background? Have you ever done any like look at the people who are actually giving you notes? Do they have degrees in literature, in writing? What are they? Where are they from?
I'm not sure, honestly. I mean, I can tell you that almost...
It's a whole mix of...
Different kind of academic backgrounds, I would say. But almost all of them, I think, started out as assistants at whatever company they're at or various production companies, networks, or studios, and kind of moved around, worked their way up the ladder until they're now vice presidents of development or whatever at different networks.
Strikes me as the wrong way to go.
I have nothing bad to say about the process. and then, you know, these people buy 60 or 70 scripts. Each network buys about 60 or 70 scripts a year. And then in January, February, they throw 90% of those in the trash can, and they make anywhere from 8 to 12 pilots in a good year. And then of those 8 to 12 pilots in a good year, they may put 3 on the air. And your odds of lasting to season 2.
This is per network.
Per network.
Yeah.
Your odds of going to season 2 are under 10%. So at every step of the way, you're against incredibly bad odds. But if you make the next Seinfeld or Friends, at some point you're cashing a check for $100 million.
Yeah.
So you're like, and that's a literal number. That's not like a joke number, you know.
You're making $100 million. You can go from, well, Whitney Cummings. I mean, I think she probably made $50 million already off of Two Broke Girls or something.
Yeah,
yeah,
that show's definitely going to go to syndication. And that's it. Like, and then once you get to that point, you're doing whatever you want. And ultimately, I think we're all in this game for that because we have ideas of what we want to do, and we just want to be left alone to do them and have enough money to do them or enough clout to get a studio or network behind you. And
but it's also very really hard for, like, you know, some people to replicate that success, like David and Max, who wrote Will and Grace.
You can never replicate. There's like one person every 30 years who replicates
Chuck
it on
Lorre.
TV. He's the guy right now. Or Norman Lear, you look at in kind of an older age.
What is Chuck Lorre's secret? Basic formula stuff, or knows what middle America really wants? Or
I'm not sure. I mean, and now we also get into some weirder conversations about what really is success in the modern media world, because that's still, his success is still assumed from Nielsen ratings, which is not really how people are watching TV. That's not really indicative of what is actually being watched.
Mm. So kids, the tastemakers, the kids aren't necessarily watching Big Bang.
I think they are watching Big Bang because of, I forget that guy's name, the guy who plays Sheldon.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about. The guy who's like the star of the show. He's won Emmys
show.
And all stuff.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's a fine show. You know, it's not any show that I would watch with regularity, nor are really any of those kind of multicam sitcoms. I watch them because of my job and everything like that, but I find that the things that really entertain me are all hour long.
Yeah. Favorite shows?
True Detective right now.
Really?
That's fantastic.
That's a show?
So good. Yeah, it's on HBO. I think it's a miniseries, but it's
an episode McConaughey 3. And Woody Harrelson?
Yeah.
Wow.
Has a very strong atheist component, which I'm a fan of. But yeah, for comedy, I find myself going to reality shows like The Bachelor, Breaking Amish, The Soup obviously is a funny show.
Yeah.
I watch Inside Edition every night for like a half hour of comedy.
That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, scripted comedy on TV is just...
Yeah.
It's just not funny.
I mean, what about Breaking Bad?
Fantastic. Yeah. One of my favorite shows of all time.
Me too.
It was so good.
What about Sons of Anarchy? Have you seen that?
No, I've never watched it.
I just watched the first season.
Pretty good or no?
It's getting there.
Yeah.
It's just not ultimately, it's certainly not Breaking Bad.
The Wire and Breaking Bad
yeah. and The Sopranos are yeah, to yeah. me.
I agree. Those are the kind of holy trinity of hour long in the modern era. It's tough though, and it's especially tough with comedy because you have scenarios where like comedy is so dependent on tone, and if one person writes a script, it is the tone of that person. It is their sense of humor.
Mm.
If you bring in someone else to rewrite it, you now have two different tones in that script.
That's right.
And it just doesn't make sense comedically.
I agree.
And it turns into kind of a pile of crap. This happens on movies all the time. It happens on TV
shows
all the time.
This is why it's so amazing when a movie breaks through all the cracks and actually does it. It's
not amazing. It's a formula. It's very simple.
Mm.
It's one guy or lady or that person's little group of people who they work very closely with.
Right.
Are left to go make something on their own, and they take almost no notes. And in every case, the best shit you have in TV or movies, it's that every time.
And why don't they replicate it? Because other people need a job.
Well, it's because of the system. They need to. Most of the executives, I think, want to be able to defer blame. So if something fails, they don't want it to be because of them. So if they say, well, we hired this guy to rewrite it, and he's super successful, not my fault. And I think really that's why rewrites happen. The rewrite to me is the most insulting thing that can ever be done in Hollywood. And I will never do one because of that.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, because it's kind of like saying, I made this thing. It's like, hey, Brian, you know, you have that wife. Can I fuck her a little bit?
Yeah.
Would you mind?
Exactly.
I mean, that is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
You take time crafting this thing that you're completely invested in, that you know the characters inside and out, they all exist in your head, and then that's just taken from you, given to someone else to do whatever the fuck they want with, and then in many cases, you're asked to stay on it and pretend that you care.
That would make me crazy.
It doesn't make you crazy. I mean, the first couple
well,
of times
guess,
it does,
I guess after
but
a while you go,
just become
oh,
numb to it.
Yeah,
you're
this is the
business.
Animal. Don't get attached to anything.
Yeah, exactly. And so then as a result,
you
don't
a
really...
slut, basically. I'm not going to give my heart to anybody. I'm just going to fuck
well,
who
Well, it becomes
who...
very difficult to care about the things you're doing because you know at that point you're only doing them for money. And if the people who are, you know, making the real decisions about whether or not it gets on the air and stuff don't really care enough to lend you the credibility that you think you deserve, having created the entire thing.
Yeah.
You know, why it just becomes very difficult to...
Do you get lied to a lot?
In terms of what?
Best script we ever read. Network really likes it. They're really happy with this.
No, I mean, I think that's actually probably genuine in the first phases when they're very happy with stuff. I think that's... But I mean, their job is hard too. You know, it's like they're...
They get fired all the time.
Of course. And they're answering to a higher power, usually the head of the studio or network or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like that fear that they have, I kind of get it. It's like they, in many cases, don't know what that person wants, what kind of shows they're going to want on the air the next year. And it's kind of a crapshoot for them as much as it is for us who are writing it.
But you're right. I mean, so many of these success stories really are the result of someone's original and untouched inspiration.
Yeah.
And that becomes the expression. And when somehow by accident it's left alone and put on the air.
Yeah.
You know,
by force. Chuck Lorre is a good example with Big Bang. I mean, 2.5 Men was already a huge hit.
Yeah.
I don't think he had to do many notes on Big Bang, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Because
it's like, really? You're going to fuck with me now?
I know that firsthand. I mean, I have friends. We have a mutual friend who worked with him.
Wow.
And he said that when somebody asked him a note from the network, Chuck Lorre started reading from the beginning of the script.
I've heard that story too, yeah.
Yeah, and he must have felt very satisfied in doing that because God knows what he went through when he was younger.
Yeah, it's a weird relationship that you have as a writer with the people who are paying you because it's like on one hand, that's your job is to work with these people and do this thing. But on the other hand, you just have to watch your thing turn into something it was never meant to be, something that you don't like.
Explain to me this whole ridiculous thing they did with anger management, where they pick up 100 episodes after they shoot the first 10 or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the reasoning was behind it.
It seems so crazy.
Yeah, they just wanted to go straight to syndication, obviously. 100 episodes.
Because they figure Charlie Sheen can sell anywhere, right? I mean, is that what it is?
Well, that was right on the heels of the big blow up with Chuck Lorre, and when Charlie Sheen was literally every news segment was something about Charlie Sheen, and he was saying, you know, had all of his catchphrases going, and he was going to do the live stage show. And I think FX probably thought they could capitalize on that, but, you know, we live in an era
now.
How
is Two and a Half Men doing now with.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't think as good as it was, but they have to fulfill I think they had 3 years left in the contract or something after he was removed.
I've never understood the phenomenon that is Charlie Sheen. Not as an actor. And not
really?
Even as a, no, I mean, I think he's fine.
I think he's super charismatic and interesting to watch. And I mean, for what that
then
show
again, to be
is,
fair, I haven't watched a lot of him.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, for what Two and a Half Men is, I think he's like perfect at it.
Yeah.
You just don't, it's
that
like,
him,
you know,
yeah.
Friends or whatever. For like a multicam sitcom cast, that's as good as it will ever be.
No question.
They were just perfect at it.
They were all great at what they did. And haven't worked much. I mean, David Schwimmer and Lisa Kudrow and, you know, there hasn't been even Matthew Perry.
Matt Perry's had a couple of failed sitcoms. He's done some movies. Yeah. Lisa Kudrow is now on that show. I think it's on Showtime that started out as a web series, web therapy.
Right.
Who else are we looking
but
at?
But they're back in it, too. They're
Joey
trying.
Lawrence is on a TV show on Showtime as well.
Yeah, that's actually
Joey
done
Lawrence.
Well, too.
Not Joey Lawrence.
Joey,
no, what's his name? Matt LeBlanc.
Yeah, Matt LeBlanc. That's
Joey Lawrence.
That's done I Character think, kind of well. It seems like a good show. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they keep renewing it. You know, and that's what I'm saying, too. Kind of like in this modern era, we don't even, like, what's doing well?
Right.
It really is only if they keep producing more episodes of your show, you're doing well.
Yeah.
Viewership,
but the big money
is kind of
the big money may be gone for a lot of people is what the way they used to throw money.
No, the
around.
Big money is still there. It's just changing. The big money, Louis C.K. and people like that are starting to tap into it. It's a direct to consumer piece of media. It's no longer network and studio, pay me my money and we'll sell your toothpaste and Diet Coke and the commercials in our TV show. It's now like I'm making this thing that you want to see. For 99 cents, you can see it. And if you have enough people that want to see it, the money goes directly to you. And they're, I mean, the network really is only a distribution model, which is dying. I think we all realize that.
Right.
And the new distribution model is just the internet. And if you have enough money to just make your little thing and put it out there and people like it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I kind of love that about, like, stand-up is that way for me.
For sure.
You know, I mean, I start developing a following and you know, you can start getting the door and that's where you make your money.
Yeah.
Then you're doing theaters and, you know, I mean, that's, it's kind of a cool way to make a living. And by the way, stand-up is, you can still have your own autonomy.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it's all up to me. I get to call my own shots. It's very difficult to be in your position, I think. I mean, you're very successful at it, but still to have to just do that time and again. I guess I lived it as an actor for so long, going into a room and doing everything I could and then coming really close and them going, nah, or getting a sitcom and not going, or, you know, or going to series and not going more than six episodes.
There is something kind of like what I was saying earlier, though. I really have adopted this attitude that's like, once I get done with like the first or second draft of a sitcom or a movie or whatever, I know that that's the thing I wanted to do with it. And then it's kind of like it's in the world. And now whatever happens with it is...
You did your work.
Yeah, exactly. And the rest of it is just typing, doing whatever they tell me.
The guy asked Philip Roth, why do you write? He goes, just to get to work.
Yeah.
I understand that. There is a proletariat.
For sure.
You know, the in us that, you know, I think if you embrace the proletariat, just show up and just do your work, it's kind of all you can do.
At a certain point, I agree.
Not even to judge it. I mean, just put it out there.
Yeah. There's certainly some things that I'm writing currently for TV that I have no wiggle room in terms of getting notes and stuff. And when I give these things to my agents and say, let's see if we can sell this, if anyone's interested, I'm going to have them give me notes before any contracts are signed. And if I don't like the notes, I'm not going to sell it to them.
Okay. Because it's so personal, or it's just something you...
I think it's just because I'm kind of tired of turning what I think are good things into piles of shit.
Yeah.
And then they don't get on the air anyway, so what's the point?
Yeah. I'm always fascinated. I'm very, very envious of... and really, not really envious, but I'm being dramatic. But I've always admired and coveted a skill set like yours. Because you seem to write... You write effortlessly. Do you outline? I mean, where'd you...
Some things.
Who taught you to write? Did you have a teacher? Did you read a book?
No. I think it was just reading a bunch, you know?
Yeah.
It's like with anything, when you see something in the world, when you're a kid or when you're, you know, in college or whatever, you see something and you're like, fuck, that's pretty cool. I'd like to do that. You start seeing as much of it as you can. You start trying to like replicate things or figure out how you'd change it a little bit. I remember, just reading incessantly. And when I went to film school, all I would do is go to the cinema library and read script after script after script of my favorite movies.
What are your favorite movies? What movies impress you?
Give me
10.
The Natural is my favorite movie of all time.
Because of the baseball connection or just...
The baseball connection, the epic hero's journey. There's a lot of shit working in that movie that appeals to me specifically. But yeah, fantastic movie. Star Wars, the first Matrix, that kind of shit, sci-fi wise, I really like. I liked RoboCop as a kid. I'm curious to see the next one, I should say. Not excited, but curious. I don't know. What are some other good goddamn
movies?
What
is it about The Matrix and those kinds of sci-fi movies that get you going? Because they changed our paradigm of thought. Well,
the first Matrix changed everything. I mean, it changed how movies were made. Yeah. And obviously, the special effects and shit were very cool. But yeah, it also deals with a lot of elements in science fiction that I really like. What is the nature of reality? What is the nature of humanity? Man versus machine? All these kind of things. Will we create our own destruction? Are we creating our next evolutionary step? All those kind of things I find pretty fascinating. But
me too. Yeah. It's also a question of learning how to look at things, you know.
Yeah.
You got any favorite actors?
Yeah, I think Daniel Day-Lewis is pretty damn good. Fassbender's good. There's a lot of good actors, to be honest. There's like some kind of middle-of-the-road shitty ones, but I really think there's like, right, and especially in hour-long TV, you get to see an actor deal with a character for like so many seasons. Like Breaking Bad's a great example.
Yeah, I know. It's the development and how they change.
It's fantastic because you just can't. I really think the best everything is being done in hour-long TV.
I agree.
It's the best acting. It's the best writing. It's the best everything.
Yep.
Except for special effects. That still is like big popcorn summer movies, but you just can't. An actor doesn't have a chance to do something like that in a movie where you're living in this character for years of your life.
Yeah.
You know? Unless you're maybe Daniel Day-Lewis doing some weird shit, whatever he
does.
Yeah,
he goes away for 3 years and becomes a cobbler.
Yeah, exactly.
Or learns to box. I mean, the guy's like, he's nuts. It's almost like the acting is second to the, let me see what I can do. It's like Christian Bale.
Yeah.
Basically, I make believe and put makeup on. Of course, I'm going to try to lose weight and torture myself. It makes me feel like a man. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, I agree.
Are there people that you would like to? I mean, if I let you have dinner with, say, three people,
living or dead or anything,
doesn't matter.
Dead? I'd probably go with Isaac Asimov. I would probably go with that might be the only one.
What would you ask him?
I don't know. I'd probably just have conversation. I mean, would I be able to resurrect him and bring him into the year 2014?
Yeah.
I would like to show him shit and be like, dude, what do you think of the internet? Dude, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? Where do you think it's all going? Because he was a futurist, if nothing else. Mm. I don't know. I mean, I don't have much curiosity, I guess, about like...
It's kind of what happens as you get older, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah. Like, I know the shit that I like.
And that's what I mean.
I don't really want to hang out with anybody. I mean, do I have to go to dinner?
It's kind of how I feel. When somebody's really good, it's like, oh, you got a really good skill set. You probably worked hard at it. And, I got my thing. And here we are. It's even like I meet, when I was a young man, I'd meet somebody who was just, a great athlete or a Steel Team 6 guy or whatever it was. And how do you do that? And stuff. Eric Clapton, he's at a bar one time. I was like, whoa, look at his hands. And not at all anymore, because they have a skill set. It's a specific skill set. It came about from an early age, and they worked hard at it, But, I got my own thing, too. And
I know. The older you get, certainly you understand the struggle, and you understand...
And the process of how somebody impressive is made,
Exactly. They're just people, and whether it was by luck, maybe
and
a little bit of hard
work. And just
because
they're good at one thing doesn't mean they're not a-holes at other things, too.
That is also
thing.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Have you been
I'm
disappointed by some people? Have you met people who...
One. I've been in the presence of one person that was like, I won't say instrumental in kind of making me decide as a kid to go do something, but certainly certainly I had seen things of his, I'll say this, as a kid that I was like, oh, that's interesting. I think I want to do something in that world. And then, seeing him do some shit that was not too cool.
Yeah.
That was kind of disheartening. I mean,
my friend said he had his favorite comedian of all time, a legend and all that, and we'll just say his name is Mr. X. Mm. And he was literally like this was his hero. It's the reason he did everything. And the guy came into the club and did a set, and it was like the biggest thing in the world. And the guy was hanging, like he looked like he was walking through rain, this young comedian. And my buddy goes, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "What's wrong is that Mr. X is drunk. He's drunk. And he's trying to pick up a 21-year-old.
What's wrong with that?
I know. But this guy was God to him. So he hung his head and walked home. Meanwhile, he expected, I guess, him to be some lofty Christ figure.
Yeah.
Listen, bro, welcome to comedy, you fucking dummy.
But, I mean, that's a weird thing to
have. Of course, it's a weird
dream
thing.
Shattered
guy,
over that.
Right. The guy was like, you know, the guy was 60 or something. And he just thought the guy was he was sloppy drunk, trying to pick up a 20-year-old or whatever it was. And
so he just saw him being human.
Right. Instead of being dignified and this guy he'd had on a pedestal his whole life. And that's kind of what happens. You get older, you go, listen, man, we're all too flawed and too human.
But it also is a symptom, I think. The dude I saw was just being a complete fucking asshole to someone who did not deserve it at all. Someone who was far below him in status and life and all this shit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That sucks.
You also get into a scenario where, like, when you're a kid, you don't fucking know what that is. You watch a movie and you're like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Right.
You don't really know what goes into it. And once you actually kind of get into this industry and you see the nuts and bolts of how
it ruins it.
Yeah, of course. Once the veil is lifted,
I can't watch movies. A lot of times, like, I'm like, a movie, huh? You know, yeah. I mean, I can, but it's just.
But I will say that it also makes me, my level of enjoyment for media now. There's just a huge fucking chasm in between. Most things are mediocre, a few things are really shitty, but the things that are fucking good that make me forget I'm watching a TV show,
I
like them so much more than I ever liked anything before.
Well, you appreciate what it takes.
Exactly. And when that all melts away, when you don't see the writing, you don't see the performance, you don't see the directing, you're just watching these fucking characters do this crazy shit, like Breaking Bad. It is mind-blowing how good that fucking shit is. You respect it and appreciate it so much more than ever could otherwise.
That's right.
True Detective is like that as well.
Really?
Highly recommend it, yeah.
I'm going to check that out.
It's fantastic. It's so fucking good.
McConaughey's been making the right choices. I used to criticize him.
Oh, yeah, man. No, this is the best thing he's ever
done. I used to always make fun of him because I thought he was very vain and very happy with his body, and he was doing push-ups, like, you know, in for the paparazzi and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, you know, where I'm from, I might have to beat you up because I'm jealous of you and you're being a peacock and I have a problem with that. But, you know, again, he's doing some good stuff now. And people, by the way, I have to say, anybody I know who's worked with him loves him. He's a good guy.
I get mistaken for him a lot.
You know, you do.
Shirtless walking around the beach.
You do. Yeah. It's funny. You're kind of a blonder.
Yeah.
Scruffier version.
Blonder, scruffier,
a little lower to the ground. Built to bear down more.
Yeah. Stronger.
Yeah. By the way, you'll hear Will Sasso talks about a blog called Bear versus Dog, and we've talked about it a lot, and that was in response to Chad saying that he might be able to give Will a fight.
I was the dog in that scenario.
Yeah, if he trained for a year and I had to school chat on the law of physics.
Well, I couldn't do it now. After my torn ACL, I think I'm out of the fight game.
Do you have a torn ACL?
Yeah, it's surgery.
It's funny, isn't it? As a man, though, you never really lose the idea of wanting to not be vulnerable. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I just have a, obviously it's incorrect, but I have an unwavering certainty that I could fight and beat almost any animal. Almost any guy, like, other than trained fighters, just some other random guy.
I'm
like, yeah, why couldn't I just fucking punch him right in the nose and that's the end of the fight? Of course I could do that.
Right.
Like, I can throw a decent fastball, throw him down
his
fucking face.
It's the same thing. And in some ways, you know, it's good to feel that way. But then in others, you know, I like to get into a ring sometimes. You know, I do it twice a week just because it just reminds me of just what some guys can do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just hilarious. I can't even hit. My buddy Tony Jeffries, I go over to Box and Burn. Now, he won a bronze medal in the Olympics. He's also 6'2 and about 205 pounds, just a bigger, better athlete, world-class athlete. Oh, and by the way, he's been boxing since he was 10. But I can't, if he doesn't want me to actually hit him, and I can, if you see me hit Mitch, you'd go, hey, bro, it looks like he's been around. No, I can't hit him.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in 3 minutes, I'm...
What do you mean, though? You can't hit him. He just puts his hands down Anderson Silva style.
He's
and
so
turns
elusive.
Into smoke?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah, basically. And if he were hitting me back, it'd be the end.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying, though. That's a trained fighter. Yeah. I'm saying, yes.
Yeah.
I know logically I could not fight a trained fighter, but just some fucking random shitbag in a bar, I'm pretty sure I could kick their fucking ass, regardless of size.
What animals do you think you could give a fight to?
All of them. I mean, not a whale even, yes, I think.
Jesus!
Eyes. I know
you'd
so much more about like anatomy and shit.
You'd go for the eyes.
Always. Anytime a fucking monster creature comes after you.
Go for the eyes.
Every time. Or if a dog is biting you. See, I think this is a major mistake most people make in animal attacks. Animals' fucking teeth, any animal that eats meat, their teeth are made so that they hinge backwards into the mouth.
Really?
So that when they bite something, that animal's going to try to run away. And when they do, it tears their fucking flesh because the teeth are angled backwards.
I see.
So if a dog bites your fucking forearm, it's a snake, it's a fucking chimp, it's a fucking tiger, it's a fucking bear.
Right.
So when an animal bites you, you don't fucking pull away, you just ram it down their fucking throat.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad to know that. My buddy's a canine guy, and he's got a German Shepherd. And he's
I'd fucking
very...
kill the German Shepherd.
No, I know you
in
would.
In a heartbeat.
But he did release it on a special force. The guy went crazy, and the dog seemed to have taken him down. But you're right. And I said to him, I said, what would you do in this? My buddy's a very tough, you know, SWAT guy, and he's a wrestler and jiu-jitsu guy and very strong. And I said, what would you do, though? How do you? And he goes, good luck. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, when they bite you, you shut down. They break through your bones and your nerves, so you can't use that arm anymore. I went, it's not fun, but not Chad Colchin.
No, they're not breaking my fucking bones.
You're not even remotely. You look like you're about to fall asleep. You're so.
I've just had this conversation so many fucking times.
It's exhausting. I went whale watching today and saw a whale.
Did it look tough? Or
it did, to be honest with you. It looked very big, and I just. And it's in the water, so I don't know how you would actually...
Water is trickier for sure.
Yeah.
No, I think most water creatures, sharks and things, could probably kill me, but I would put up a fight.
You would?
I think they would probably never attack a human again.
They would remember you?
Yeah.
They'd be a little bruised up. You're not going out without a swing fest.
They'd at least lose one eye, maybe two.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You'd go a couple knucks deep in that doll eye, in that great white doll
eye. I'm telling
eye.
You, I'm either ramming my fist down the throat of the thing that bit me, or I'm taking out their eyes immediately, and then the fight's over.
And then the fight's over.
Yeah.
Amazing. And then you breaststroke or you crawl to shore? Probably butterfly.
It depends on what happens to my arms, I guess. Yeah,
I guess you're right.
Might just be some quick kicking. I don't know.
If you have no arms, you just dolphin back.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
I can do that.
I'm very impressed.
I don't know. I mean, I don't actually think I could beat what... I could beat a bear. I do think I could. If I'm really honest with myself.
But you're 5'9 or so, and about 165, 170. I mean, a bear can be 700, 800, 1,000 pounds. How would you navigate?
Yeah, but their eyes. It's, again, the eyes and the nose. If you fucking hit an animal in the nose, it runs.
Really?
And when it runs, you track it down and kill it.
A bear.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it just seems that they come at you with some force. I just don't know.
I know logically this sounds fucking retarded, but I am really certain I could do it. If I really am, like, digging the depths of my mind for honesty with myself, I really actually think I could. I know that sounds fucking insane, but I really do
think
I could.
You think you could beat a bear in a fight?
Yeah.
Okay. And
I do.
Would you have a knife in your hand? Or just,
no.
Oh, no, just bare hands.
Yeah.
Sharper nails or just blunt?
Nothing, dude. All you need is one fucking finger in its eye. That just fight
like
that. Is over.
Jesus.
It's over.
Right.
I'm sorry, they're animals. If somebody pokes you in the eye, you understand, the fucker's still coming at me. I still have to fight.
Right.
You have awareness.
Yeah. You don't have any, firsthand empirical data on this, but you just feel it in your heart.
Yeah. No, I've never killed an animal.
But animals.
I mean, that's the bigger thing. I actually like animals. I wouldn't want to harm the bear, but.
So you may not even, you may take the bite, play dead.
No. If something's trying to kill me, I don't care what the fuck it is. I'm killing it first.
Would you throw some kicks? Because I know you do a little Muay Thai.
That's right. I don't know. The ACL may not let me. No.
Oh, right.
So I would never kick a fucking bear. That's like offering a chicken leg. Just here you go, dude.
It's
here's your first meal.
It's really one finger. Really what you're saying is you could beat most animals with one finger.
With one finger, one strategy. It's like Ronda Rousey. She has her arm bar. I have the eye poke. I really think every animal is susceptible to it.
All right.
Just because they are given to natural instinct.
Yeah.
And as soon as their vision is gone, the fight is over.
No adrenaline or worry about that.
What are they going to do? They can't see you.
Well, they have another eye, but yeah.
Yeah, I do both.
Oh,
simultaneous.
You do both. Right, I got you.
No, you know what
I'm
saying.
Which seems to open your throat and your chest up to a full frontal.
Good luck seeing it when you're blind.
I got you. I'm sorry.
I'm saying yes. No, 99% of the time, the bear would fucking kill me. But I do believe there's a 1% chance I can blind it quickly enough that it does not. And I believe that that same chance exists with every animal on planet Earth.
Not a blue whale.
I think I could blind it. I really do. If I was... Again, all things have to be aligned correctly. I have to see the whale coming at me.
If the whale was in a harness and you had a... You know, and they presented the eye to you and you were able to jab your... Yes.
I would go limp. I would pretend like I was just a piece of driftwood or something.
Or plankton or whatever they eat.
No, I wouldn't pretend like I was something they eat. I'd pretend like I was just...
But you have a shrimp... There's a shrimp color to your skin a little bit.
Well, that's not my fault.
Okay.
That's my parents.
Right.
All right. I would cover myself in sea mud like Schwarzenegger and Predator so that he couldn't see my heat signature.
Oh, now that makes sense.
Right. And then I would jab him in the eyes with both fingers.
So he couldn't see your heat signature. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we covered that. Right?
Yeah.
If you could be a pro athlete at one sport, what do you think it'd be?
MMA.
Really?
Oh, fuck yeah. I couldn't imagine. I mean, I played baseball growing up and obviously had aspirations, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure hitting a home run would be fucking fantastic. There is something, it's not something, I know exactly why I like MMA so much. It is the purest form of competition that exists on planet Earth.
I agree 100%. I say
it all
the time.
Two fucking guys who are roughly the same size, who could have trained in anything they wanted, who have essentially the same access to the same set of skills, are entering a fucking confined space, and they're going to test that skill set against one another.
I couldn't agree more. It's why I had this podcast, The Fighter and the Kid, with Brendan Schaub.
Yeah.
We talk about this stuff. It's why I've always been fascinated with fighting.
Me too.
And MMA especially.
Yeah, because it's the fewest amount of rules. It's the most pure form of competition in the combat
sports. Joe Rogan said, it's as close as you can get to watching two men kill each other with their bare hands.
Yeah.
It is the purest form of sport because you're basically naked and let's go.
Yeah.
The only thing you can't do is bite and gouge.
In the old days, yeah.
But I wouldn't even want to see that kind of fight because I actually like the skill set of, you know, trying to knock somebody out and choke them and, you know, all that stuff. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's some restrictions put on modern mixed martial arts. Yeah.
Back in the day, you fought with, you know, war. There's a big difference. We've made a big jump in civilization because we can kill at a distance. Back in the old days, you had to kill everything close up and personal. You could smell.
Well, I mean, the distance has only gotten greater. The gun, you know, was obviously bow and arrow if you really want to get down to
your
sling.
Now you got drones.
Now you have a drone where, the distance
you're
I can kill
Florida.
You from is 4,000 miles.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's interesting. I'm all for it, though. I'm way into drones. Love them.
Yeah?
Yes.
Hmm. Do you have a drone?
I'm having one built for me.
That seems like it costs a lot of money.
Not really. I got some USC engineering students. It's not for warfare purposes. It's for artistic purposes. But
will it have lasers? Or?
No. Just flies around. Does weird shit. Little camera on it.
Because you could use it to blind almost any animal if you wanted.
That's right. If you give me a drone, then I can definitely fucking kill any animal. But no, I'm into modern warfare in that aspect that we really don't need human beings anymore.
I was invited by my SEAL Team 6 guy buddy to... hunt hogs. Hogs are a real nuisance in Texas. To hunt hogs from a helicopter with a belt-fed machine gun.
Did you do it?
I've not done it. I've been invited.
I don't think I could do that.
Well, I would eat the hog. I'm not going to go kill them just for sport, though you're supposed to because they need to be. You know, the population's out of control. But I don't want to wound a deer, a pig.
Their population's out of control. You know what else is out of control? Humans. Do they have that in Texas?
And by the way, I'm not even so sure that's true. I just know that a lot of hunters say that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, the pigs are running everywhere. Yeah. I've been in Texas many times. I've never seen a pig.
I lived in Texas.
Didn't hear anybody complaining about Texas. I mean, about pigs.
I've never seen a pig.
But that's what hunters like. Nah, look, man, they're a nuisance. There's so many. We got to get into a helicopter and blast them from, you know, with a machine gun.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I will kill a hog from a helicopter if it means I got bacon for a year because I love pig. So
I would rather just buy the bacon in the store. I don't want to be present for the death of the animal. I can eat flesh and I do frequently, but I don't want to be present for the death.
I just don't want to hurt. I don't want anything to suffer. But I eat animals.
Yeah.
So if to kill one myself, I've never had a problem with as long as I do it, you know, responsibly.
Fair enough.
I don't like hunting deer actually. Because
I've never hunted anything.
I've done it twice, and I did it for this TV show. And I don't like killing a deer because there's something that I have to disassociate because I like them. I mean, they're just little animals.
And yeah, they're cute.
They're delicious. But I don't like taking a peaceful animal and blasting it, you know, a hole through it. It just doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I do, when I do it, I make damn sure I've got a really good shot. I'm going to get it through the heart and it dies right
Let
away.
Let me ask you this. In the near future, we'll be able to clone and synthesize any kind of meat we want. So yeah, there will be no more
meat without death. Central nervous systems. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Would you still hunt in that era?
It's a good question, and I've actually thought about it because I know we're on the cusp of that kind of meat and that kind of food production. And the answer is probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Yeah,
I don't like – I actually don't like – I'm not crazy about guns. I like fighting. I like martial arts and all that. I don't like guns. I don't like the noise. I think they're just – maybe it's the difference between fighting is a sport, and then guns are so final and violent that kill mm-hmm. they kill things, you know. But I'm again. I mean, I like eating deer meat, and I'll eat a pig, so I'm probably going to shoot a pig from a helicopter.
Yeah, shooting from a helicopter, I think, would be a fun experience in and of itself.
Well, I'm going to be with a bunch of like, you know, commandos, tier one commandos. It'd just be interesting to see how they, just the experience of seeing these uber warriors. You know, in a you know, just seeing how they handle guns, and it's just a very interesting kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. It's a very weird thing too. I feel like we've reached an era where the soldier is really kind of obsolete.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We certainly have different rules that we have to follow in warfare and stuff. But if we really wanted to kill Osama bin Laden, did we need to send in dudes to shoot him in the head? Mm. We should no. Of course not. We could have had a drone take out the entire complex.
Well, we wanted to make sure that he was there. That was a big issue.
Even if he wasn't. Hmm. Annihilate it. Maybe he was there, maybe he wasn't. We'll keep looking.
Then we wouldn't know for sure if he was there.
I'm sure they could have gotten his body out of the rubble and all that kind of
tough
stuff.
Tough to do, though, sometimes.
Maybe. Who knows?
I mean, I can't go into why, but it is. Trust me. You just keep waking up free every morning, and I'll do what I do.
Fair enough.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Chad Colchin. And just so you know, I'm going to be in... I'll be at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City, February. I think it's February. 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. And then I'll be at the Punchline in San Francisco, the 27th, 28th, and 1st of March. So the 27th of February, 28th of February, and 1st of March. So that's New York and San Francisco. And then I'll be at House of Comedy in Minneapolis after that. God.
It's busy.
I'm on the road, bro. Thanks for doing this podcast. You're outstanding.
My pleasure.
I knew you'd be good.
Yeah, well.
Doesn't surprise me at all. What is your... Yeah, do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, I do, but there's nothing on it.
Yeah.
Just look at me on Twitter.
You don't need anything to self-promote. You just write in a room.
Yeah, if you want to buy my books, just go to Barnes & Noble or something.
Yeah, but what are the books?
Average American Male
That's
is one
of
them.
That's a great book. Everybody should read that book.
Yeah, you can get it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or wherever you like to buy books. There's another one called The Lie. There's another
excellent
one called
book.
Men, Women, and Children.
Which is the movie that Jason Reitman adapted.
That movie will be out later this year.
Men, Women, and Children.
Uh-huh.
And talk about what that book's about a little bit.
It's about a group of families. So like a set of adult characters and then a set of junior high age children characters who are their kids. And it's kind of about how social technology is changing the way we interact with each other, how it's widening the generation gap, and how it is sexualizing children at a much, much younger rate.
Hmm. Jesus.
Yeah.
That's Chad Colchin, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you call a deep thinker.
We did it.
If you don't want to do any thinking, you come see my stand-up. We sure did, Chad. Let's go out there and do some drinking.
All right.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.